welcome back to Demand, the Business of Gaming. I'm your host, Chills, and with me, as always, is Raul, my co-host, business development specialist, and game economist. Hello, Raul.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing all right today. How's everything on your side of the fence? Virtual side of the fence as well.
I'm also all right. Yep, staying busy. So, today, we have a very popular, unlikely hit. Yes. Mount and Blade.
Yes.
Tell me about Mount and Blade.
Well, Mount and Blade is a, not a series, but the original Mount and Blade was kind of an interesting concept. It had what is essentially a real-time map that you would travel around, kind of basically nearly 2D map, and you would basically play a soldier of fortune, a mercenary leader, and you would get embroiled in like town versus town in a kind of like historical seeming but fictional world, and the interesting part is that it combines something like 5 or 6 known systems outside of it, including the combat was kind of the standout. You were a third person and you led your troops on the field, and it would be different conditions, different types of battlefields, but they were very small conflicts. You were talking like 100, 200 people in the first one, and then they would individually be there, sometimes it'd be less. You'd be running where most of your troops have died. But the action was very the combat was very action oriented. The role playing systems were pretty good for what is essentially a small project game that eventually grew into what most people probably recognize more likely as Bannermen, Bannerlords, the second one, Mount and Blade 2. All of that would be fantastic on its own. But the reason, I think a core reason it basically hit so big is that modding was actually a feature of the game from the beginning. So
yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I actually wasn't aware of that. I know the games have had modding, but I actually didn't realize it was kind of a present, you know, from the inception of the series.
Absolutely. It was one of their tenements of the game is that you could mod it right from the first version, which was literally called Mount and Blade. Their second version of the game was called Mount and Blade Warband, which then added more features and stuff like that. Mount and Blade Warband is the one I talk about most because it was kind of like the most internal systems meets the ability to mod. So even today, the game is played fairly well for a game that came out in 2010. Some of the possibilities.
Real quick, I should mention that 2010, Tail Worlds Entertainment.
Yes. Tail Worlds Entertainment. Mount and Blade.
Sorry, go ahead.
And so the series has had people working on it for a good chunk of time, 15, 16 years now. The idea here is that with just the basic first game, you would be, the second game, actually, Warband, you would be able to travel to Star Wars, Game of Thrones, Middle Earth, and alternate history, Roman history, stuff like that, very easily. And basically, the gameplay is similar, but
it's through mods, you're saying?
Through mods.
These other settings.
And some of the mods combine with each other. So you want a Jedi, you know, taking the throne of the Iron Throne of the Seven Kingdoms? It's possible. It's possible. But I'll talk about more why modding is a core feature in successful gamings in our next segment. But to give all proper respect to the accomplishments of Mount and Blade, it was a very small studio in a country not known for gaming. Basically, they hit it out of the park, and they deserve all their things. They were also very dedicated to improving their craft. Something I talked about last time was the ability to stick with a game. In this case, they brought out different versions as they themselves got better and better as a studio and were able to tackle more complex engines and engine difficulties and stuff like that. The most modern one is Mountain Blade 2, Bannerman, and it really is quite impressive now. And that's why it's only gaining momentum instead of losing momentum as a series.
Agreed. I think I always felt like the Mountain Blade series was very ambitious in terms of the kind of game they were making. And even though sometimes it seemed like some of the systems were a little half-baked, and I don't mean that really as a criticism. I just mean that they'd set their sights on making the game they wanted to make with the systems they wanted in it.
Certainly.
And like you say, I think it was their dedication and their persistence that drove them to keep improving on it and fixing what were maybe half-baked on release and then became really solid and well-implemented systems over time.
Much like I've talked about before in my LinkedIn articles, the developer is the one, not even the audience really at this point, the developer is the one that says that they'll throw in the towel, not anybody else. It just doesn't work like that, right? Like, you can put pressure on the developer and so sometimes say, well, the public did this. Public is not in charge of your life. The public can help you or hinder you, but they are not in charge of your life as a developer. You are in charge of your life as a developer. You say when you want to move on, not the public per se. Demand is very important. The reason the show is called Demand is because I believe that is the driving force of all economies, by far. It's not even supply like other people talk about. In this case, for entertainment purposes, the person that creates the demand is the supplier of, like, they don't actually have to be there. Pardon me.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I mean, really, when you make, like, an art product of any kind, entertainment product, in a sense, you have to create the demand because no one needs a video game or a movie or a novel. Those aren't necessities. You know, the demand for food is, you know, built into to human existence.
The thing is, what we're talking about here is actually, you know, old hat to all the marketing and advertising and social media people in gaming. They are the ones that create the excitement for a brand new game, a movie, a book even. So they know what we're talking about, probably better than most people in game dev production side, right? Because Here's the thing. There was a very famous Picasso quote that says, eventually the artist needs to walk away from the art. And that is true in gaming as well. But since gaming can always be upgraded, it's less of a mantra. Because if you look very closely, Concerned Ape, the producers of Stardew Valley, was one guy, and he refused to give it up. He hasn't actually done, I don't believe, any other game, but he's continued to improve his core game and now has hired a studio full of people to help him do it because he believes in the vision of his game. All power to him. All power to him. Dwarf Fortress, we talked about this before. Those two brothers went through hell and high water through very rough and lean times where, you know, donations were the only thing putting food on their plate. Here's the thing. Yeah. They stuck with it. Now they're millionaires. And their game is basically the basis for a whole new genre of stuff like, RimWorld. There's a dozen
Minecraft games. Yeah.
Minecraft.
I mean, Minecraft was heavily influenced by Dwarf Fortress.
Yes. So, like, my opinion is that you know, the modding itself is a feature, and we should probably go into this. I heavily suggest you haven't tried any of the Mountain Blade series. There's a Steam sale, and there's always sales on these games. The developer is very into putting their games on sale so that more people can play it. Please search for them. It's Tail Worlds Entertainment, Mountain Blade series.
Mountain Blade 2, Banner Lords, I believe.
That is the nicest and most well done of them. Probably for most players, if they don't want to see the originals.
Right. The most recent.
The most recent release. And they continue to improve it weekly.
Okay, great. So, yeah, I think we've kind of started to move into the main topic. But as you mentioned, the main topic today is modding. Games that are moddable. So what is modding? Let's start there.
Okay, so modding is the players or a community of people that enjoy a game want to add something new. A good example of this is my unlikely hit favorite mod for Skyrim, and there's many. I mean, I don't. There's innumerable Skyrim mods. This one is special to me because it's hilariously weird. Basically, the only thing it does is it adds a companion that follows you around and punches people. That's the movie Batman from the 90s. It's basically dressed as him and he punches people. That's all he does. You just walk, he follows you. I don't even know if they added a voice line thing, but it would be hilarious. So, point being here, right? Like, modding is not a thing that would be, oh, sure, would be nice. If a game has the architecture to add modding at all, you should. There's concerns. There's always concerns about games, like with modding. What happens with the core product? Does the core product lose identity? Is the branding weaker? Is there legal issues? And the answer to all of that is yes. That is all a very real risk. However, as I noted in my article on LinkedIn, Minecraft and GTA 5 are the two best-selling individual video games in history. They both are mod and capable. In fact, Minecraft is so...
And you don't think that's a coincidence? You think that's
not a coincidence. It's not. Not all of the best-selling games are mod-enabled, but enough of them that you see, well, this is crazy. Why didn't I do this before? You know, kind of thing. I advise... Basically, this is the whole thing. Modding your product is adding time that they spend on your product. It's a no-brainer. The more they love your product, the more they trust you as a developer. And anything you come out afterwards, they will probably at least try. It's basically a method to give goodwill to your players, but also to empower their creativity. When there's a space game with modding, almost one of the first things that happens is that the mods begin to resemble Star Trek, Star Wars, and now The Expanse, and other things. Babylon
and 5. Same with the fantasy setting, you'll see Game of Thrones,
Lord of the Rings. And so forth and on. You want your players to do this. They're not playing your original setting, if there is one. They're not playing your core game. But at the end, they're playing your game, and your game is still referred to in high reverence because it is an outlet for them, both for play-wise and for their creativity. What point would there be to stifle that in order to prevent some minor risk that may not never happen anyway? Likely won't happen anyway.
So I agree, and I think those are some real good points. What I want to do first, or real quick here, is so we talk about modding, and it's kind of a known, established part of gaming. However, when I was growing up, when I was young, you know, a teenager and younger, modding was not a thing at that time. In fact, I remember being a young teenager, and I bought a third-party software that lets you use AutoCAD to make your own levels in Doom, or Doom 2, basically by creating the geometry that the Doom engine would read when it loaded a level. And I thought it was fascinating, not just because I wanted to make levels in a game, but because it was the only thing in existence that I knew of at that time where that was possible. And for a long time, even when modding became more prevalent or, you know, less unknown, like I think of Neverwinter Nights for the PC, it had the engine, the creator engine, Morrowind, you know, basically came packaged with the engine. It was still also a PC-only phenomenon, essentially.
Right.
And now we see, like you're saying, it's not universal, but a lot of games do take the approach of, if not releasing the full engine or the full tools, allowing some elements or some degree of the game to be modded, and even cross-platform support for console players to download and play on mods, and so on.
Right.
And I think it's been a fascinating, you know, journey seeing this, like you say, become something that now the best games, the top games, are known for. You know, I've personally put thousands of hours into Crusader Kings 2. And a good few hundred of those were in the Game of Thrones mod. Because sure. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
There are some criticisms of modding, which is, and you can see this, I think, with Starfield, some of the criticisms of, you know, recently in Starfield, which is the devs expect the players to do bug fixing and basically to fix a game.
Yes.
And what do you, so, I mean, what's your thoughts on that? What's your...
Well, using it as a crutch and using your fans' fandom as a almost like a unintended employee action is wrong.
Yeah, unpaid volunteer labor.
It's ethically wrong. You hire people for that. Bethesda has had plenty of money under ZeniMax, and it has even more under Microsoft. The way they have run their modding, it's at first it was great, and now there's almost an obligation, and I don't think long term they can keep that up.
Well, I mean, Starfield doesn't look like it met expectations. I think we can safely say that without being controversial.
No, yeah. Unfortunately, some of the most glaring ideas is like, you know, the one thing that I can only imagine they spent so much dev time on is landing the ships. Nobody wanted to land the ships, like as a mini game. Nobody liked it. It was very difficult. It was not fun. It added nothing. So immediately somebody modded so that basically you would just like press a button and land. That's all.
You just warp. You hit the button and warp down basically.
And you're done. And I mean, why? What possessed them to force this on the player? And then the only answer they had was to literally erase it, the entire thing from the game.
That doesn't make you feel great.
Mods can do a lot, and they add a lot to everything. However, dependence on a community, or in fact even usury of a community, is not ethical, and in the long run it will be resented and your company will suffer for it.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because this, you know, something you said earlier about it made me think about how earlier you mentioned that, you know, the developers shouldn't blame the players, things go wrong. And it made me kind of reflect on how there sometimes seems to be this, like, hostility between the developers and the players, or the developers and the gamers who don't play their game.
Right.
And I don't think that's healthy, and I don't think that's ultimately going to lead to success for a studio to have a aggression or hostility towards your audience.
Well, in a way,
or to exploit them, like you're saying. I mean, just,
yeah, you know. I can't really speak to the hostility part, but I can only speak to the part where
By hostility, I just mean like blaming them if the game doesn't sell. That's all I mean. I don't mean anything beyond that.
Yeah, but like that's every relationship is two ways, right? The fans or the consumers are one party. The sellers are the other, or artists are the other party. Honestly, relationships go bad both ways. I've never been in a relationship of any kind, whether it be romantic, platonic, friendship, family, where the relationship went bad and it was just one person's fault. Although there could be a majority, right? A vast majority even of like particular blame. So partially, I would say that the way gamers treat their the companies in gaming is reflective of how they get treated in return. There is a kind of ivory tower thing happening with AAA studios, and it has been happening for like the last 5 years, where there is a bit of separation, not a bit, a lot of separation from their intended clientele, which are just, you know, people that want to play games. So there is that, but that partially it's exasperated by the way the fans treat the gamers, the game companies as well. There's often harassment of especially people that are more on the vulnerable side in the gaming world. They seem to be harassed constantly to the point where a lot of them leave the gaming industry because it's not worth it to take this harassment, basically overdoing their job, trying to create something that they like, that they think will be very good for the audience or the project. It's not fair either way.
Agreed. Yeah. And I wasn't trying to make any implications.
I'm just clarifying. Yeah, yeah. But how it relates in the terms of almost a third category, how does a company relate to its creators? There's actually very good, mod creators, people like that. There's some good examples. Right. One of the things I like about Paradox, the way they treat their creators in the mod section, is that they usually feature like mod of a particular game in regular articles. You can see them on Steam, on their websites. Like they'll have best monster, race made, and then there's like a whole bunch of entries. So
yeah, like a showcase.
It's a
like
showcase.
A mod showcase.
Not only are you giving credit to the people who have put things, but you're actually driving interest in your primary game. Because The more people are interested and more people see that their hard work in creating mods is actually appreciated not only by other fans, which is the primary thing, but by the company itself, you win. It's much like the way I liked Five Nights at Freddy's used to be handled. Whereas a lot of companies become litigious with fan projects, they were the opposite. They not only encouraged it, they would feature it. Like if there was a fan-made movie or an animation or maybe some music, they would feature it all over their social media, right?
Oh, cool. I didn't know that.
In this way, it's a bit like modding, but the modders still have a long way to go, right? The interesting thing about like modding is that it also creates new studios. There's a few companies I'm thinking of. One is they made a movie called they made a mod for Warhammer Total War series called SFA, right? Where it's the most popular mod series in that game. They're now a small studio in the gaming world. I believe it's Lidless Eye. I'm trying to remember their game. It's basically a very, very dark, you can imagine, after coming out of Warhammer world, Warhammer Fantasy world. It's a very, very dark game where you run basically an apocalyptic cult with a dead god that you worship. It's hilariously weird and very dark, but it's awesome. I will present it when we present this article.
Sure,
So I will put it down. I will talk about it. But basically, that conversion happens a lot. Gary's mod is literally a mod.
I was just about to mention Gary's mod,
And I talk about Gary's mod in the article, right? Yep. So Facepunch Studios never existed. It was literally Gary making a mod for what is basically the core engine that the Steam developed a ton of its shooters on, right? So he made this mod. Basically, I don't even think he knew where it was going to lead. And it led to him making his own studio and then having successes beyond Gary's mod. So one of the interesting things is that by total accident, modding has become a way for new games and new studios and whole new philosophies of gaming to happen. Many people are not old enough to remember, but Warcraft 3 birthed all MOBAs. Because Ice Frog and a guy called Ginsu basically created between the two of them, Ice Frog was the main creator, Dota, the first Dota, Defense of the right. Ancients. And they created basically a whole new game style, and everybody did what they did. And so, like, you'll have Smite, and you have League of Legends. All of them are based on this idea that modding, tower defense is also basically rooted heavily as a genre in Warcraft 3 because of the mod flexibility, right?
So, in fact, I think you can trace a direct lineage between Warcraft 3 through Dota to the character Ashe in League of Legends, whose model is the elf archer, basically, from like Warcraft 3 originally. I mean, the DNA is right there.
It's there. And it's not a secret. It's just, it's been slow. No. Things go on and we lose track. But modding is not all. Is an indirect way of telling the, like, in my opinion, this is more on the artistic or gamer enjoyment side. Modding is a way to create new games, new styles of games, in for the future. They may just test it out on this system or that system, but eventually they're going to sit around the mod team and go, if there's more than one, and say, hey, why don't we just make a game out of what we made out of for this game, and then we can do it ourselves? This is how Riot started. This is how there's numerous companies. Hi-Rez in Georgia, they started because they had a MOBA called Smite. And it was very much, they had a new business model that they were running and all this stuff. So my feeling is this. If you're worried about the lack of creativity in gaming and you are a gaming studio, make your game moddable and see what happens. Two things will happen. I'm almost 100% sure. If you get a certain amount of playthrough within the first 6 months of your game and people realize they can mod and those tools are not completely arcane, I'm looking at you, Crysis. I think what you'll have is return and return and return on your time and investment for making the moddable tools for your game as well as your game.
Agreed. I think so too.
It's a small investment, and sure, it takes time. Everything takes time, and there's bugs and all sorts of stuff. It takes time and effort. So most people want to rush and just get their game out because, you know, it's that mania, that endorphin rush, right? But honestly, take the time. If your game is at all possibly moddable, do it. Terraria, and on and on. There's so many. I don't even remember half the games I was going to talk about during this time. Oh, Baldur's Gate 3. One of the successes is that while Larian Studios is a masterful studio at making role-playing games, and really deep narrative in particular for those things, and the vanilla game is amazing, people have started adding things from all over the D&D world, all epics, all eras, because the system is that flexible. You can simply add and subtract, and you do not have to have a computer science degree. Make your tools accessible as you can, and as flexible as you can, for any game that you release. I think it will be. I think there's almost no examples I can think of where modding wouldn't enhance your sales and your outreach and the playtime of the players on your game.
I agree. And in fact, even for games that you would think wouldn't really be accessible for modding, like something that's persistently online or competitive, even World of Warcraft allows modding for the UI tools.
Yep.
So even though you're not modding maybe the game content or the balance of it because it's online and multiplayer, you can still modify your experience of the game and how you interact with the game, the tools, at least insofar as the buttons and the UI and the stats that are displayed and so on. But one thing you mentioned kind of made me think, there's a game that came out last year, I believe it was last year, it's been recently, Scald the Black Priory, published by Raw Fury. It's a kind of old school turn-based RPG, kind of like the old Goldbox TSR SSI games, Pools of Radiance, those games.
Right.
But recently, just in the last maybe months or a month and a half. I think it's just one guy is the actual like main developer, has been releasing tutorials along with the dev tools or the engine dev tools, basically showing people how to use them to make new modules, new scenarios, or modify the core game.
Right.
And I think it's a great approach. You know, he's not just relying on people to figure it out themselves, but he's basically made a whole little class on his website where you can go and learn how to make this game, you know, how to make scenarios in this game. So I think if there's a good example of a company and a developer doing exactly what you're describing, I think Skull of the Black Priory is a great example of that. If someone wanted to pick up a game and pick up some basically fairly basic or at least beginner to intermediate set of tools and make something that's theirs, make something new.
Yes.
That's a great place to start, along with, you know, the other classics, Roblox and Minecraft, you know. But if you wanted to make something in that aesthetic, that style, Skull of the Black Priory, great game.
I agree.
That's just recently started doing what you're saying.
Hey, the thing is, there is a kind of like development crunch, right? It takes a certain amount of money, a certain amount of effort on your team to make the tools and allow the thing to. I want to talk about something else though that I forgot to mention earlier. There is a hidden part of modding, right? And you should take care of it as a studio. The legal framework of what can be put and what it allows, and you know what happened to the games that you get modded. These things are important to consider, and I would definitely ask a IP lawyer specifically. I can recommend several, but the idea here is that you need to do this work because it not only protects the people that are going to be modding, it protects you as a company and your liability. You need to understand that is a big, big thing. It is just as important as the usability, which I've already talked to and we agree on. But like, legal framework is important in this manner because it can quickly run out of control and perhaps even take your company and studio and game down with it. So do the due diligence in this case.
Yeah, 100%. It's something that I think any developer should look into and take action on. I do think that there are some best practices that are kind of deemed sufficient or deemed the way to go about doing it. So I don't think there is considered to be a huge risk if you do things right.
My reason for mentioning that
is I don't want to discourage anyone from doing what you're describing, which is making games moddable.
Yes.
But yes, please protect yourself.
Protect yourself and included, protect your modders as well.
Right.
Because it will, all of that, unfortunately, we live in a very litigious world and things can get real bad in a second. So you need to do as much ahead of time. You can't predict everything that's going to happen to your startup studio or your indie studio. You can take the steps that other people have taken to protect yourself. And I highly encourage legal as well as business frameworks for your studios.
Agreed. And we can make a similar message, I think, to gamers, to players that want to be modders or make mods, which is be aware that you most likely won't have, you know, the copyright over something you make as a mod. You probably won't be able to monetize it. Just kind of go into that with your eyes open as well from the player, the gamer, the modder side. Most likely it's going to be, like you're saying, something you make out of passion for the game, not as a business move,
no,
at least not on its own or immediately or without the game kind of specifying.
Yeah, so. I'm sorry to talk over you. It shouldn't be the primary focus of your efforts. However, it is noteworthy that a lot of like very good modding groups get absorbed by their company. Rockstar absorbed probably the most popular server and mod team in GTA ever history.
Oh yeah,
and they absorbed them. They bought them out, and now they're part of Rockstar as a separate studio working on projects. And like I mentioned earlier, there's plenty of studios that have begun their existence as modding groups or individuals.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, it can almost, it can definitely be a path to getting into the industry or getting to make games professionally or commercially. You know, agreed. I think we've seen that through history. I just meant be careful about making assumptions of what the legality and the status of a mod might be.
Certainly. Monetization has almost never happened of your mods. It is likely a model that might be explored in the future. But it will,
yeah,
it will,
with few exceptions, I think Roblox, you know, a couple things along those lines, but
all right. And even those are highly litigious efforts on the Roblox company, and in particular, so you'll be aware that it will not be easy at this point. Because basically usually the legal framework says something like everything that you make under the mod system belongs to the company, in providing the game and the tools basically. And that's pretty common, and not to stress a point. Some may be that way.
I agree. That's very common. Yeah.
So, just be aware, and yeah, definitely write one of us if you have any comments on mods or questions on mods from our perspectives. Definitely give us either one of us our, you know, a ring on LinkedIn or Discord or any other method that we have. And we will try and answer as best we can from our perspectives.
Yep. Feel free to reach out, 100%. So, Raul, any final thoughts on modding?
I think it's worth the effort for companies to do it, even for smaller games that you think are never going to have a community. That's what people said about Terraria, and their modding community is huge. Their game continues to be played in its original form and modern form to this day. It's a way to extend player usability of your game and your visibility. As more people play it, more people will join to play it because people want to play together or see what the fuss is about. So there is a wisdom there's an observation that most games make their majority of their money in the first few months of its existence, and then almost nothing afterwards. When you have a modding enabled thing, that dovetail gets longer and longer and longer, because they may not even want to play your original game, but they heard about this cool mod that lets them be like, you know, elves from World of Warcraft in your game that's actually sci-fi. So I think if considered like this, it makes the dovetail of your game much, much longer, and the potential for it to continue long after, everybody else is already packed up and moving on to the next game. You have a chance here to make your game stand out by empowering your players to help you make your game stand out.
Yeah, that's very well put. Great thought. All right, well, thanks again, everyone, for listening, for joining us, and we will see you next time on Demand.
Take care.